Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, the assistant editor of the New Books Network. And you're listening to New Books in Political Science. Today I'm speaking to Nomi Claire Lazar, Professor of Politics in the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Ottawa. Her book, Out of Joint, Power, Crisis, and the Rhetoric of Time, from Yale University Press, explores how political leaders use constructions of time to frame events. This imaginative book asks us to consider how calendars, clocks, and periodic events legitimate political orders. Nomi, thank you so much for joining us today on the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
So the first question, as standard with New Books Network, is if you could just tell us a little bit about your background and why you chose to write this book.
I, by training, am a political theorist, a political philosopher, and I've always had an interest in crisis and moments where things, you know, shift and change and how that comes about. So my first book was about states of emergency and how we manage those in liberal democracies. And then I sort of had a moment where I took a sharp turn, shall we say, into this other area, which seems at first to be unrelated. So it makes sense maybe to explain how I got the idea for the book and how it came to captivate me. So when I was a kid, I had this weird, nerdy fascination with clockworks. And I used to like to go and get old, broken down clocks from the jewelers and take them apart and try to figure out how they worked and all of this kind of thing. And I had mentioned this to a cousin of mine who then presented with me with a book, sort of a history of clocks and calendars as a birthday present. And as I was reading it, by then I had my PhD in political science, I was very struck by this strange phenomenon that all of the major calendar reforms had been undertaken by political leaders who were in the midst of crisis. Of major upheaval, regime change, and from a political scientist perspective, this is very strange because at those kinds of moments, there's so many draws on your resources. So if you're Julius Caesar or Kublai Khan, if you've just conquered a new territory or started a revolution like the French revolutionaries, why on earth does it occur to you at that moment when you've got all of these problems? To reform the calendar, which seems like such a weird technical kind of exercise. And if it had just happened once or twice, you might say, okay, it was just some quirky thing with this guy or that guy. But because there is this strong correlation across different cultures, so every dynasty founding Chinese emperor, Julius Caesar, Augustus, Ataturk, Lenin, Stalin, the French revolutionaries, Pol Pot, I could go on and on and on. So at that point, when you see this happening through history across different cultures, you have to ask you have to think, okay, there's something else, something deeper going on here. And what do all of these leaders have in common? They are all facing a challenge of legitimacy. So if you're putting into place something that's new, you need to convince people that they should accept it or at least tolerate it. So this then generated the puzzle for the book, which is essentially, what does time have to do with legitimation. So if we start from the hypothesis that all of this tinkering with time is somehow related to the legitimation problem, then how are these two things related? So that was how I came to write this book on political temporality, which at first doesn't seem to have that much to do with states of emergency, but of course it is also dealing with these situations of crisis and radical change.
Before jumping into the sort of broader theories that you pull out of these examples, it's worth going over and looking at a couple of the examples that you talk about in the book. So, you know, you talk about various different things, but I think that a lot of people in school or just in general, if they're familiar with any kind of story of a kind of a calendar change, they're familiar with the Thermidorian reaction. So I was wondering if you could talk a little about the French calendar reforms and then also the Julian calendar reforms. And just, you know, maybe any other examples of these reforms to sort of give that listeners an impression of what that looks like.
Well, those are actually two examples that go very well together. So maybe I'll start with Julius Caesar. So as your listeners might know, that there was a lot of corruption in Rome. And one of the ways that this political corruption manifested was that the calendar was variable, and how long the year was a political decision. Now, how can that be? That is because if you have a sort of a lunar calendar and you want to make it match up with something like a solar year, you have to add extra days because they don't line up. So many cultures have had an intercalary month, which they add at certain junctures to try to line things up again. But because Rome's political offices were a year in length, and because the person who decided how long the year was going to be, like whether there was going to be this intercalation period or not, was an elected official, you ended up with this weird situation. And it was, in fact, the Pontifex Maximus whose job it was. Where if you wanted to keep your enemies outside of Rome, for example, or you wanted to give some ally of yours extra time in their office, you could decide whether or not to actually make the year longer. And this had become so wildly out of control that when Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon on the 10th of January, which I always remember because it's also my birthday, it was January, but it was also autumn. So the year had just become totally out of whack. And this became a sort of symbol for the corruption of the Roman political system in general. And so when Julius Caesar took control, many of his reforms had to do with both substantively, but also symbolically correcting corruption, cleaning up corruption. So he borrows this model from the Egyptians of a much more rational, a much more scientific year. And in this, and by reforming the calendar in this way, sort of insinuates that he's the man whose rule is in line with reason, is in line with science, as then understood, and with purity, because it was in line with these things, right? And he's restoring sort of the human calendar to nature. So even nature's on his side. He is, his rule is sort of justified and legitimated because he is the man of reason, the man of nature, the man of science. All of that is on his side. So that's helping him legitimate his power. And so, we see echoes of that, of course, in the French Revolutionary calendar, we know that the French revolutionaries changed most of our units of measurement, right? So it's not just, we know about the calendar, but they also kind of bring into place all of these decimal systems of measurement, which we retain everywhere except, the U.S. and I think it's North Korea or something. We use this metric system. And so what's actually interesting, and there again, we have this sort of attempt to align this shift, this political shift with what's natural, what's scientific, what's rational, but also in the French Revolutionary case, to socially engineer when people have leisure time. So they extend the week to 10 days, right? So it's a decimal week. And that kind of mixes up when there is a Sunday, which then makes it hard to go to church. So it sort of takes away from the power of the church and kind of engineers the work-leisure balance in a way that's quite interesting. So here's the thing. So you would say, okay, Julius Caesar's calendar reform sticks. Like, we still use a version of that. The French Revolutionary calendar, which seems to be trying to do the same thing, is the only decimal measurement they brought into effect, which we no longer use, right? And so that's an interesting puzzle. Why does this rationalization of the calendar work and this other one not work? And my hypothesis, which I have not proved but would like to put forward, is that Julius Caesar gave people more days off and the French revolutionaries gave people fewer days off, more work, less rest. And that most of the calendar reforms that kind of mess around with people's leisure time and who they can socialize with tend to fail, which is an interesting kind of feature. So they tried to do the same type of thing, this naturalization, legitimation thing, and they failed. And I want to suggest maybe for that reason, too few holidays.
Yeah, another example of that you give in the book is Joseph Stalin reforming the attempts to reform to a 5-day work week for greater efficiency. And you point out that part of the reason why that fails is that when there's no days off, then the machines will break and then no one will fix them. Another thing that you talk about too, that you sort of examine is you look at constitutional preambles and the way in which constitutions, these kind of legal foundings and the ways in which the preambles will speak to this kind of historical significance of this new founding regime. So I was wondering if you could discuss the two examples that you bring up are the Chinese Constitution in 1982, and then also the Hungarian Constitution of 2012. So I was wondering if you could speak about those examples as well.
Sure. So I do talk a lot in the book about calendars and clocks, but there's another way that political leaders harness time to legitimate or delegitimate power, and that's through conceptions of the flow of time. So if we think about how we experience time, we always experience it through marks and measures, whether that's different kinds of clocks, different calendars like the academic, religious, and Gregorian calendar that we might use simultaneously, et cetera. So we mark time in different ways that allows us to experience time in different ways. But on top of clocks and calendars, we also use these sort of grander arcs of time. So ideas of progress and cyclicality, ideas of apocalyptics or eschatology. So the notion that time will someday come to an end. We use primitivist ideas that we're looking back to this harmonious Eden and comparing the corruption that we're in now to this past time. And so these kind of narrative arcs are also very politically useful because they allow political leaders to suggest what the future holds. So if you think about an event, a contentious event, what's going to make people accept that? So in the case of constitutions, a new constitution, a new way of having the government run, the political leaders need to convince people that it's good for them, right? That it's a promising thing for their future, that it's going to fix something in the past and give them something for the future. But how do we know what the future holds, right? We can't tell the future. And it's not like a political leader is going to stand up there and make social science type arguments about probabilities and causalities and stuff like that. But instead, what many leaders do in the preambles to constitutions is they use these familiar narrative arcs, not the content. I mean, the content of the events is there, but what's really important is the shape of the story, which we tend to recognize. So for example, I use the example of the 1978 to the 1982 preambles of Chinese constitutions. So in the 1978 preamble, the rhetoric is quite eschatological. So it's still deeply, deeply Marxist. And all of the rhetoric is about sort of struggle and being in the midst of this chaotic moment. And the purpose of this struggle is that soon we're going to sort of reach this point of resolution, essentially. So then, of course, there are So in that way, the drafters of the Constitution are telling the Chinese people what this Constitution means for their future, what the event of the Constitution means for their future. This is what we're reaching toward. This is what we're trying to achieve. So between 1978 and 1982, you have this massive political upheaval in China, and suddenly, you know, Deng Xiaoping is, has got power, and, we have the Age of Reform, and we get this new constitution coming in just 4 years later, where this struggle toward this moment of resolution is no longer what is being promised to the Chinese people. So instead, in the preamble there, you have this much more sort of progressive narrative that, oh, we're going to step forward together, bit by bit, we're going to move ahead, it's going to take work, but it's sort of this much more kind of progressive type of narrative that says to the people, you know, we're no longer in this chaos that's reaching toward this resolution, but instead now what this constitution means is we've taken this turn toward this kind of progressive somewhat capitalist way of being. So by contrast, you asked about this other example, which is the Hungarian constitution. So in Hungary, Viktor Orban brought this constitution in 2012. It on the basis of very little consultation, and he's at that point starting to move Hungary away from Europe toward this idea of like principled illiberalism. And he needs to tell the people a story about why this is happening, right? And why it's good for them. And there in that preamble, he uses this narrative, which he's used since the late 1990s, of a sort of a grand cyclic rise and fall. So he's always comparing the year 1000 with the year 2000 and saying, you know, in the year 1000, St. Stephen founds Hungary, and they rise, you know, we rise to glory, we're this wonderful people. And then in the 20th century, you know, we're up at this pinnacle, all these forces from outside attack us, basically, and drag us down and make Hungary gray and miserable. And now, he says, you know, it's always, and now we're going to, you know, refound in the year 2000, the Hungarian people with its special identity, and rise again toward glory. So what does this constitution mean? Which, you know, to political scientists, it means Orban is concentrating his power in a way that's going to be very difficult to disentrench. But what he's telling the people of Hungary that it means is that thanks to me, thanks to this constitution, we're not going to let these outsiders drag us down anymore. Now we're setting out on this great, glorious rise. So this is this conception, you know, this grand cyclic conception of the flow of time, which is constructed through picking out different events from Hungarian history, almost like if you think about dot paper, right? You pick from all the many events you could pick from that traces out the arc through the present moment and tells you what's going to happen next.
You know, by him sort of framing in that period of time, it makes it seem like, you know, whatever regime he's founding is going to last for this extremely long time. And yeah, another example you discuss is also the Mayan calendar, which, I was wondering if you could talk a little about the Mayan calendar and the significance of these periods of time that will obviously far extend, you know, the length of the regime and the political significance of that.
Well, that's a really interesting question. And the Mayan calendar is important for several reasons. And one is that it presses against this cliched notion that other people and other times thought that time moved in circles. And now we moderns have this linear conception of time that presses against that. Because almost every culture, I would say, actually go so far as to say every culture, simultaneously uses cycles and lines. And that is certainly true of the Mayan calendar, which has these important cycles, but it's a type token distinction. So so you can say, well, time moves in circles, right? Like we go from January and back to January again, but it's not the same January because we're also moving in a line. And all human beings have this capacity to sort of differentiate between the type of movement of events and the token event. So yes, it's January again, we're going in a circle, or yes, it's noon again, and look at that modern clock face that goes round and round and round, but it's not the same noon that it was yesterday. It's another noon along this line. So the Mayan calendar is important from that perspective. But you know, your question about, so what happens if you kind of set out this narrative of, you know, why your power is legitimate that has this endpoint. So this is what happens in classical Copan, which is an important Mayan city, when Yaxcucmo, who's this conqueror, he arrives from the north and he takes over this city. And he says, and he arrives right at the beginning of one of these important cycles in the Mayan calendar. And he basically, in all of his propaganda, ties the legitimacy of his power to the fact that he arrived just at this very special moment. So it's almost like it's destined. And he says, and my power will last through this whole cycle, right? It's a cycle of 400 years in this case. And his descendants then are continually tying their power, the legitimacy of their power, directly to their connection to Yaxcucmo, the original guy, not to their father, for example, and to his claim that his power would last for this whole 400 years. But here's the problem, right? What happens when you get to year 380? And it's striking that Copan lasted, its power lasted for almost exactly 400 years. And then of course there's, that could be a coincidence, or it could be that, the other things that are going on, soil degradation, so there's hunger and starvation, there's a challenge from a nearby city, et cetera, that these things are interacting with people, you know, the fact that the ideology that's been sustaining power is starting to crumble as well. So that could potentially also be a factor. But of course, you know, we don't know, because we only have documentation. So we have archaeology, but we only have documentation from the ruler's perspective, not from the people's perspective. But we do know that people started to leave Copan in vast numbers around that time, leading to its virtual collapse almost exactly 400 years later.
In your book, another sort of example that you talk about, and is sort of the central, I think, if it would be fair to say, the central sort of case study, is the Mongol Emperor Kublai Khan. So I was wondering if you could talk about Kublai Khan's calendar.
Sure. It occurs to me I should also point out, okay, so if you do set out this kind of grand cyclic thing and say, oh, my power is going to last through the cycle or something like that, or my power is going to sort of reliant on glory of some kind. This does present a challenge for most regimes, that power does seem to diminish. And that I argue in the book, just in case anyone finds this interesting, that this is one of the reasons why countries have national holidays, because, you know, Machiavelli sort of calls this resuming the government, right? Reminding people of the government's power. So you stick it in the calendar, and then nobody has to do the actual reminding, because the calendar just brings it automatically every year, this rehearsal of the fundamental, you know, the foundational values of the society. So national holidays are a very devious, effective time technology for legitimating power. But that aside, okay, so Kublai Khan, such an interesting guy. Anyone who has not read about Kublai Khan, I recommend not just that you read my book, but that you go out and read whatever you can find, because it's truly a fascinating political case study. So Kublai is evidently Mongol. He arrives in China and manages to kind of unify the country, but he's not Han. He's an outsider. So he declares himself to be an emperor and founds a new dynasty, the Yuan dynasty. And then he's got this big problem where he needs to convince Chinese people that he has legitimate power to be an emperor, essentially. And so one of the things he does is he undertakes this vast and super expensive and super amazing, from a history of science and technology perspective, reform of the Chinese calendar. And he does this for several reasons. The first is that every dynasty founding Chinese emperor reforms the calendar, but most of them do it in this kind of, tinkery sort of way. So Kublai, he's got this extra legitimacy challenge. So he's like, I'm going to go, you know, whole hog on this and do this, you know, and be really impressive at it. So if we, you know, if you think about it, like, if we know that this is the doctor because she's wearing the lab coat with the stethoscope and she has a certain bearing, right? So this person acts like she's the doctor. So that signals to us that she's the doctor. So Kublai acts as though he's the emperor. He does the things that emperors do in order to signal that he is in fact a legitimate emperor. And one of the things that emperors do is they reform the calendar. But there are several other, and he does it better, right? He does it better than anyone else, which then also shows that he has all of this power and capacity to rule because he spends so much money. And he's able to draw these scholars from all over the world with this expertise in astronomical instruments and things. So he makes this sort of display of his wealth and his power. So that's also another signal of legitimacy, that he has the capacity to kind of engineer this kind of thing. But in addition, the reason why emperors are always reforming the calendar is that in a lot of cultures, it's not just what you do that makes, like with respect to religion, for example, that makes you pious, but when you do it. So it's not just that you go to mass, but that you go to mass, you know, at or to particular masses at particular times. It's not just that you go to synagogue or to mosque, but that you do it at the right time to mark a holiday, for example. And similarly, a lot of ancient cultures like the Assyrians and the Chinese have this this important notion that it's not just what you do, but that you do it at the right time. And the only way that you can know that the timing is right is by having an accurate calendar and an almanac that goes along with it. And this is why, so this is like an important aspect of infrastructure, you could say, that the emperor needs to provide to people. And in doing so, the hope is that everything will go well, that crops will grow nicely, there'll be plenty of food, there'll be security. And that in itself in Chinese political thought becomes a symbol or a sort of a signifier that the emperor is legitimate. So when things are going well for the people, that shows the emperor is legitimate. When things start to go badly, that suggests that the emperor has lost the favor of heaven. So for all these reasons, Kublai sort of faces his massive legitimation challenge as an outsider, as a Mongol who is now ruling China through this calendar reform. It achieves legitimacy on so many different levels.
Something I found interesting is this kind of framing that you say that like these calendar reforms are extremely radical acts. However, the act itself is one that positions a new regime or a new political order in some larger history. So it actually, you know, even though it's forward looking and it's this new thing, it actually references the past. So, you know, you sort of talk about this idea that, you know, one way of counteracting or undoing order is this thing that you call primitivism. So what is primitivism in your mind? And what is its relationship with this politics of legitimation?
So if you think about it, politics is chaos, right? Things are always changing. Everything's dynamic. Nothing's ever really fair. It's sort of, you know, if you take a step back, politics is a bit like somebody threw all the plates on the floor and everything got smashed, but everyone's kind of going along with things, pretending that didn't just happen, right? They're pretending that things aren't chaotic and awful, that the world is not full of domination and misery and unfreedom. So most politics kind of takes place in that space of dynamism. And either we just have this sort of level of tolerance for it, or we have ideologies that make us, that sort of trick us into thinking that that things actually are, you know, maybe not perfectly just, but they're more or less okay, right? But there are some people who just cannot take it. They can't stand it. They say, this is not real, right? What's real is that there's domination and suffering and misery, that there's chaos and injustice and nothing, you know, things look like they're well-ordered, but they're not. And it's just not tolerable. You can't fix it. You can't reform it. You just have to smash it, basically. You have to sweep it away. And essentially, the people who look at the world that way want things to stop, right? They don't want movement. They don't want chaos. They want order. a just order that's self-ordering, where you don't need domination to maintain it. They want quiet, and they want things to be sort of in this natural harmony that, you know, doesn't require maintenance. And that means they want time to stop. So people who work to undermine legitimacy, you often use one of two conceptions of the flow of time that are related to the endpoints of time, either before time started or after time's going to end. And the before time started people I call primitivists, who sort of harken back to this period when people lived close to nature, and so everything was sort of idyllic. And they describe these sort of idols as a way of pointing out how corrupt and miserable and awful our current built space, ordered space is. Okay, and so that's a good critique. That's a good lament. It makes us suitably depressed when we sort of compare it to this, you know, before time, before the earth started spinning in Eden, you know, before time starts, before there are events, before there's change. But if you really want to get, you know, clean up the mess, you could say, you have to stop the earth from spinning. So there's sort of this initial inertial force, right, that starts events, politics, the world spinning, and takes us out of this wonderful, idyllic pre-time, right? And now you need an equal but opposite force that's going to stop the world from spinning. It's going to stop time and bring us into this space of peacefulness again. So those are sort of eschatological or apocalyptic ways of or sort of conceptions of the flow of time that we find in various kinds of Marxism, and that we find in various religious movements as well, of course, right? So that there will come a time when there's a final battle between good and evil, of however those are conceived, and that ultimately good will triumph, and then we're going to move into this other space where we don't need domination anymore, where the world is self-ordering and everything is just, and we're peaceful and nothing happens anymore, right? Heaven is a place where nothing happens, as the Talking Heads once aptly said.
It reminds me of this saying that William F. Buckley would say a lot about, that trying to stop the imminentization of the eschaton, and this sort of standing athwart history and yelling stop. And I find it very interesting how you kind of show this sort of similarity, that these ways of thinking about time in a political context don't necessarily neatly divide along standard political lines and boundaries, but, you know, there's something sort of a deeper underlying it. Just a general sort of question, and, you know, you could take this in whichever direction you'd like, but, you know, what was some of your, you know, understanding of some of the other literature or other theorists' discussions of politics and time, and some things that you think certain thinkers have gotten right and wrong, and your sort of intervention, because this is really, I think, a subject that prior to reading your book, I had not really encountered very much.
Before I get into that, it might be worth pointing out. So you say, you know, you said that it's interesting to think that there might be something deeper than the actual, you know, the surface ideology going on here. And this is one of the things that I'm writing about right now in terms of apocalyptic politics, that you know, it's long been a puzzle why people move sometimes, you know, bizarrely between, you know, being fascist and being Marxist, for example, among different kinds of extremism. So how can that be, right? Like, how can you be ready to kill or die for one thing and then for its opposite? And so one of the things that I'm investigating is the notion that it's the ideology, the sort of the substance, is not what's important. It's the frame. It's the apocalyptic frame. It's this need to stop time, basically, to restore order, that might be the real draw. If that bears out in my research, then that, you know, could be an interesting sort of insight into why people are attracted to various kinds of extreme politics. And you know, might pose questions for like how we might talk to people differently in attempts to sort of de-radicalize and things like that. In terms of the kind of more general scholarship on politics and temporality, there's kind of an explosion of it right now, but not that much scholarship prior to you know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. So until reasonably recently, there wasn't that much political theory, at least, on the subject of time and politics. But there had been some interest from the historian of political thought, J.G.A. Pocock, and then more recently, the Stanford political theorist, Allison McQueen, both of whom were looking at the role of eschatology in political thought. So Pocock, for example, argues that we can't really understand Hobbes if we don't read the last two books of the Leviathan, which nobody ever does. Like, so few people read the last two books that my copy, when I bought it in the late 90s, it's dated from 1909, and the pages had never been cut. So how many libraries had this book sat in and no one had ever read the second half? But the second half is all about apocalypse, right? It's all about religion and apocalypse. And the argument is that that a lot of politics takes place as a result of these sort of apocalyptic uprisings, right? And that, unsurprisingly, a lot of theorists develop their political thought as a response to that. So McQueen argues that this modulates Machiavelli's thinking quite a lot, as well as Hobbes' thinking. So there's sort of that thread in the study of politics and time. And right now, there's a big movement of scholars working in international relations and time. So Kimberly Hutchings and Andy Home, who are interested in the ways that the way you know, in timing, right? So how we conceive of this moment impact how we understand what's happening on the global political scale.
You said you were talking a little bit about just the first part of your answer to that question, just about this apocalyptic, this kind of relationship between apocalyptic politics and this, you know, how could someone move from being a Marxist to a fascist, or how could someone move across these boundaries? You know, I think that a lot of the, a person at least, I'm wondering if you have looked at, is like Steve Bannon and his kind of, you know, apocalyptic Christian ideology, and the way in which, you know, Bannon has said this before, that, that, you know, one of his biggest political influences is Vladimir Lenin. And on the face of it, if someone, nobody knows anything about that, you know, without this frame, that doesn't make any sense. But, you know, obviously to you, that probably makes perfect sense. You know, you mentioned a little bit about some of the new things you're working on. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, your current interests and research and how you are continuing this examination.
Certainly. So one thing that's interesting, you know, that jumped out at me from what you just said is the importance of distinguishing between rhetoric and ideology. So, you know, right now I'm working on this project about how apocalyptic actually works. So a sort of a political theory of apocalyptics, particularly as it relates to, you know, extremist movements, but how it also fails to work. So if you think about climate rhetoric, that's very inflected by apocalyptic, right? So if you think about apocalyptic art and film and novels and things, they often feature climate disaster. And conversely, climate activists often speak in these totally apocalyptic terms. But it might be, so in the book, I make it sound like, oh, you know, political leaders can use these frames because we're all familiar with them from our just biology, right? That our lives move in lines, but, you know, our experiences also move in cycles with the seasons. And also we know that eventually we're going to die. So there's always this sort of eschatological element, but we know we can sort of map our lives onto grander cycles and all of this kind of thing. And so I sort of argued, like, we're very susceptible to all these just different conceptions of the flow of time, but that is not true of apocalyptic, which tends to appeal to a subset of people incredibly powerfully, so that they're willing to do all kinds of crazy things, but almost never appeals to the mass of people, suggesting that its use, so the use of apocalyptic framing in the climate activism, might be seriously counterproductive and actually turn people off on the one hand, and on the other hand, that we should be paying attention to the ways, you know, if so, because it makes people act in these extreme ways, right? We should, our ears should be attuned whenever we hear this kind of apocalyptic rhetoric, but we should be careful not to conflate it with ideology. So you talk about Steve Bannon, right? But another place where we're, you know, and then of course there's QAnon, right? Which is completely this apocalyptic type of frame. But we're also seeing a ton of apocalyptic rhetoric coming out of Russia right now during the Ukraine war, right? So there's all kinds of apocalyptic talk in the Russian media, in Russian propaganda. And this has led some people in the Western media to point to certain Russian thinkers like Dugin and say, oh, you know, Putin, you know, he's the brain of Putin, and this, the, you know, Putin is an apocalyptic guy, and we're all headed for nuclear destruction. But leaders, I shouldn't laugh, leaders use rhetoric that is useful to them to legitimate something they want to do at a particular time, and they know they have to reach several different audiences. And so we should expect not that apocalyptic forms like a stable, continuous kind of rhetoric like we would if it were really an ideology, but instead that it would be modulated, that it would be sort of trotted out at particular moments for particular purposes, and then kind of put away. That it can, it's useful for mobilizing people, but you don't want people to be mobilized all the time. You want them sometimes to be quiet and do what they're told. And this is why if you think about, you know, the early Christian church, once it's established also as the official religion, it's not that the apocalypse goes away, but people are told, you know, don't speculate when it's coming. So you push it off into the future, right? The Mormons did the same thing once they became established as a political entity. And we would expect to see that as a hypothesis. This is what I'm sort of testing, you're looking at right now. We would expect to see that kind of temporal modulation of the use of apocalyptic rhetoric, right, in extreme movements as well. So at the moment where you want to get people up and moving, to mobilize them for violence, or to kind of get them to kind of congeal around a certain movement or something like this, you're going to trot that out, and then you're going to put it away because it's so dangerous, or you're going to sort of modulate the timing of apocalypse, like, oh, that's way in the future. And that's only ever going to appeal to us, or the imminent, right, apocalypse is only ever going to appeal to a subset of people. So that's what I'm working on right now. Like, how and why does apocalyptic rhetoric work? And when doesn't it work? And why doesn't it work?
Yeah, that sounds like a really interesting project, and look forward to seeing where you go with that. I think, you know, this book has been out for a couple of years now, and I was wondering if there is anything that you wrote in it that you feel has sort of been, you know, either confirmed or something, you know, anything that you wrote where you feel like maybe your views have shifted.
So certainly my views have shifted around. Like, I think that my understanding of apocalyptic has changed, that I was not, when I was writing the book, taking into account how different it is from these other forms of rhetoric. Other than that, once you start paying attention, and I would encourage your listeners to pay attention, it's just confirmed and confirmed over and over again that at these pivotal moments, political leaders trot out time talk. So whether they're reforming a calendar or kind of introducing an innovation or explaining what a moment means, almost guaranteed important speeches will contain this kind of temporal rhetorical framing that tells you what the present moment means for your future. And so I would just, you know, encourage your listeners to be attuned to that, because it is a sort of manipulative form of rhetoric, and a particularly effective one. So we should just be conscious of that as democratic citizens.
Well, Nomi, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network. It was great speaking with you, and look forward to having you on again in the future.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed our discussion.